Unfaithfulness on some point to the integrity of the message means a dangerous weakening of catechesis, and putting at risk the results that Christ and the ecclesial community have a right to expect from it. It is certainly not by chance that the final command of Jesus in Matthew's Gospel bears the mark of a certain entireness: "All authority has been given to me, make disciples of all nations, teaching them to observe all I am with you always." This is why, when a person first becomes aware of the surpassing worth of knowing Christ Jesus, 77, whom he has encountered by faith, and has the perhaps unconscious desire to know him more extensively and better, hearing about him and being taught in him as the truth is in Jesus, 78, there is no valid pretext for refusing him any part whatever of that knowledge. What kind of catechesis would it be that failed to give their full place to man's creation and sin, to God's plan of redemption and its long, loving preparation and realization, to the incarnation of the Son of God, to Mary, the Immaculate One, the Mother of God, ever virgin, raised body and soul, to the glory of heaven, and to her role in the mystery of salvation, to the mystery of lawlessness at work in our lives, 79, and the power of God freeing us from it, to the need for penance and asceticism, to the sacramental and liturgical actions, to the reality of the Eucharistic presence, to participation in divine life here and hereafter, and so on. Thus, no true catechist can lawfully, on his own initiative, make a selection of what he considers important in the deposit of faith, as opposed to what he considers unimportant, so as to teach the one and reject the other, by means of suitable pedagogical methods. 31. This gives rise to a second remark. It can happen that in the present situation of catechesis, reasons of method or pedagogy suggest that the communication of the riches of the content of catechesis should be organized in one way rather than another. Besides, integrity does not dispense from balance and from the organic hierarchical character through which the truths to be taught, the norms to be transmitted, and the ways of Christian life to be indicated will be given the proper importance due to each. It can also happen that a particular sort of language proves preferable for transmitting this content to a particular individual or group. The choice made will be a valid one to the extent that, far from being dictated by more or less objective theories or prejudices stamped with a certain ideology, it is inspired by the humble concern to stay closer to a content that must remain intact. The method and language used must truly be means for communicating the whole and not just a part of the words of eternal life, 80, and the ways of life. 81. Ecumenical dimension of catechesis. 32. The great movement, one certainly inspired by the Spirit of Jesus, that has for some years been causing the Catholic Church to seek with other Christian churches or confessions the restoration of the perfect unity willed by the Lord, brings me to the question of the ecumenical character of catechesis. This movement reached its full prominence in the Second Vatican Council, 82, and since then has taken on a new extension within the Church, as is shown concretely by the impressive series of events and initiatives with which everyone is now familiar. Catechesis cannot remain aloof from this ecumenical dimension, since all the faithful are called to share, according to their capacity and place, in the Church, in the movement towards unity. 83. Catechesis will have an ecumenical dimension if, while not ceasing to teach that the fullness of the revealed truths and of the means of salvation instituted by Christ is found in the Catholic Church, 84, it does so with sincere respect, in words and in deeds, for the ecclesial communities that are not in perfect communion with this Church. In this context, it is extremely important to give a correct and fair presentation of the other churches and ecclesial communities that the Spirit of Christ does not refrain from using as means of salvation. Moreover, some, even very many, of the outstanding elements and endowments which together go to build up and give life to the Church herself can exist outside the visible boundaries of the Catholic Church. 85. Among other things, this presentation will help Catholics to have both a deeper understanding of their own faith and a better acquaintance with and esteem for their other Christian brethren, thus facilitating the shared search for the way towards full unity in the whole truth. It should also help non-Catholics to have a better knowledge and appreciation of the Catholic Church and her conviction of being the universal help towards salvation. Catechesis will have an ecumenical dimension if, in addition, it creates and fosters a true desire for unity. This will be true all the more if it inspires serious efforts, including the effort of self-purification, in the humility and the fervor of the Spirit in order to clear the ways, with a view not to facile irenics made up of omissions and concessions on the level of doctrine, but to perfect unity, when, and by what means the Lord will wish. Finally, catechesis will have an ecumenical dimension if it tries to prepare Catholic children and young people, as well as adults, for living in contact with non-Catholics, affirming their Catholic identity while respecting the faith of others. Ecumenical collaboration in the field of catechesis. 33. In situations of religious plurality, the bishops can consider it opportune or even necessary to have certain experiences of collaboration in the field of catechesis between Catholics and other Christians, complementing the normal catechesis that must in any case be given to Catholics. Such experiences have a theological foundation in the elements shared by all Christians. 86. But the communion of faith between Catholics and other Christians is not complete and perfect. In certain cases there are even profound divergences. Consequently, this ecumenical collaboration is by its very nature limited. It must never mean a reduction to a common minimum. Furthermore, catechesis does not consist merely in the teaching of doctrine. It also means initiating into the whole of Christian life, bringing in full participation in the sacraments of the Church. Therefore, where there is an experience of ecumenical collaboration in the field of catechesis, care must be taken that the education of Catholics in the Catholic Church should be well ensured in matters of doctrine and of Christian living. During the synod, a certain number of bishops drew attention to what they referred to as the increasingly frequent cases in which the civil authority or other circumstances impose on the schools in some countries a common instruction in the Christian religion, with common textbooks, class periods, etc., for Catholics and non-Catholics alike. Needless to say, this is not true catechesis. But this teaching also has ecumenical importance when it presents Christian doctrine fairly and honestly. In cases where circumstances impose it, it is important that in addition a specifically Catholic catechesis should be ensured with all the greater care. The question of textbooks dealing with the various religions. 34. At this point another observation must be made on the same lines, but from a different point of view. State schools sometimes provide their pupils with books that, for cultural reasons, history, morals, or literature, present the various religions, including the Catholic religion. An objective presentation of historical events, of the different religions, and of the various Christian confessions can make a contribution here to better mutual understanding. Care will then be taken that every effort is made to ensure that the presentation is truly objective and free from the distorting influence of ideological and political systems, or of prejudices with claims to be scientific. In any case, such schoolbooks can obviously not be considered catechetical works. They lack both the witness of believers stating their faith to other believers and an understanding of the Christian mysteries and of what is specific about Catholicism, as these are understood within the faith. 5. Every body needs to be catechized. The importance of children and the young. 35. The theme designated by my predecessor Paul VI for the Fourth General Assembly of the Synod of Bishops was catechesis in our time, with special reference to the catechesis of children and young people. The increase in the number of young people is without doubt a fact charged with hope, and at the same time with anxiety, for a large part of the contemporary world. In certain countries, especially those of the Third World, more than half of the population is under 25 or 30 years of age. This means millions and millions of children and young people preparing for their adult future. And there is more than just the factor of numbers. Recent events, as well as the daily news, tell us that, although this countless multitude of young people is here, and they're dominated by uncertainty and fear, seduced by the escapism of indifference or drugs, or tempted by nihilism and violence, nevertheless it constitutes in its major part the great force that amid many hazards is set on building the civilization of the future. In our pastoral care we ask ourselves, how are we to reveal Jesus Christ, God made man, to this multitude of children and young people? Reveal him not just in the fascination of a first fleeting encounter, but through an acquaintance growing deeper and clearer daily with him, his message, the plan of God that he has revealed, the call he addresses to each person, and the kingdom that he wishes to establish in this world with the little flock 87 of those who believe in him. A kingdom that will be complete only in eternity. How are we to enable them to know the meaning, the import, the fundamental requirements, the law of love, the promises, and the hopes of this kingdom? There are many observations that could be made about the special characteristics that catechesis assumes at the different stages of life. Infants. 36. One moment that is often decisive is the one at which the very young child receives the first elements of catechesis from its parents and the family surroundings. These elements will perhaps be no more than a simple revelation of a good and provident Father in heaven to whom the child learns to turn its heart. The very short prayers that the child learns to lisp will be the start of a loving dialogue with this hidden God, whose word it will then begin to hear. I cannot insist too strongly on this early initiation by Christian parents, in which the child's faculties are integrated into a living relationship with God. It is a work of prime importance. It demands great love and profound respect for the child, who has a right to a simple and true presentation of the Christian faith. Children. 37. For the child there comes soon, at school, and in church, in institutions connected with the parish, or with the spiritual care of the Catholic or state school, not only an introduction into a wider social circle, but also the moment for a catechesis aimed at inserting him or her organically into the life of the church, a moment that includes an immediate preparation for the celebration of the sacraments. This catechesis is didactic in character, but is directed towards the giving of witness in the faith. It is an initial catechesis, but not a fragmentary one, since it will have to reveal, although in an elementary way, all the principal mysteries of faith and their effects on the child's moral and religious life. It is a catechesis that gives meaning to the sacraments, but at the same time it receives from the experience of the sacraments a living dimension that keeps it from remaining merely doctrinal, and it communicates to the child the joy of being a witness to Christ in ordinary life. Adolescence. 38. Next comes puberty and adolescence, with all the greatness and dangers which that age brings. It is the time of discovering oneself and one's own inner world, the time of generous plans, the time when the feeling of love awakens with the biological impulses of sexuality, the time of the desire to be together, the time of a particularly intense joy connected with the exhilarating discovery of life. But often it is also the age of deeper questioning, of anguished or even frustrating searching, of a certain mistrust of others, and dangerous introspection, and the age sometimes of the first experiences of setbacks and of disappointments. Catechesis cannot ignore these changeable aspects of this delicate period of life. A catechesis capable of leading the adolescent to re-examine his or her life and to engage in dialogue, a catechesis that does not ignore the adolescent's great questions, self-giving, belief, love, and the means of expressing it constituted by sexuality, such a catechesis can be decisive. The revelation of Jesus Christ as a friend, guide, and model, capable of being admired, but also imitated. The revelation of this message which provides an answer to the fundamental questions. The revelation of the loving plan of Christ the Savior, as the incarnation of the only authentic love, and as the possibility of uniting the human race. All this can provide the basis for genuine education in faith, Above all, the mysteries of the passion and death of Jesus, through which, according to St. Paul, he merited his glorious resurrection, can speak eloquently to the adolescent's conscience and heart and cast light on his first sufferings and on the suffering of the world that he is discovering. The young. 39. With youth comes the moment of the first great decisions. Although the young may enjoy the support of the members of their family and their friends, they have to rely on themselves and their own conscience, and must ever more frequently and decisively assume responsibility for their destiny. Good and evil, grace and sin, life and death will more and more confront one another within them, not just as moral categories, but chiefly as fundamental options which they must accept or reject lucidly, conscious of their own responsibility. It is obvious that a catechesis which denounces selfishness in the name of generosity, and which without any illusory oversimplification presents the Christian meaning of work, of the common good, of justice and charity, a catechesis on international peace, and on the advancement of human dignity, on development, and on liberation, as these are presented in recent documents of the Church, 88, fittingly completes in the minds of the young the good catechesis on strictly religious realities which is never to be neglected. Catechesis then takes on considerable importance, since it is the time when the gospel can be presented, understood and accepted, as capable of giving meaning to life, and thus of inspiring attitudes that would have no other explanation, such as self-sacrifice, detachment, forbearance, justice, commitment, reconciliation, a sense of the absolute, and the unseen. All these are traits that distinguish a young person from his or her companions as a disciple of Jesus Christ. Catechesis thus prepares for the important Christian commitments of adult life. For example, it is certain that many vocations to the priesthood and religious life have their origin during a well-imparted catechesis in infancy and adolescence. From infancy until the threshold of maturity, catechesis is thus a permanent school of the faith and follows the major stages of life, like a beacon lighting the path of the child, the adolescent, and the young person. The adaptation of catechesis for young people. 40. It is reassuring to note that, during the Fourth General Assembly of the Synod and the following years, the Church has widely shared in concern about how to impart catechesis to children and young people. God grant that the attention thus aroused will long endure in the Church's consciousness. In this way, the Synod has been valuable for the whole Church, by seeking to trace with the greatest possible precision the complex characteristics of present-day youth, by showing that these young persons speak a language into which the message of Jesus must be translated with patience and wisdom, and without betrayal, by demonstrating that, in spite of appearances, these young people have within them, even though often in a confused way, not just a readiness or openness, but rather a real desire to know Jesus, who is called Christ, 89, and by indicating that if the work of catechesis is to be carried out rigorously and seriously, it is today more difficult and tiring than ever before, because of the obstacles and difficulties of all kinds that it meets, but it is also more consoling, because of the depth of the response it receives from children and young people. This is a treasure which the Church can and should count on in the years ahead. The handicapped. 41. Children and young people who are physically or mentally handicapped come first to mind. They have a right, like others of their age, to know the mystery of faith. The greater difficulties that they encounter give greater merit to their efforts and to those of their teachers. It is pleasant to see that Catholic organizations especially dedicated to young handicapped people contributed to the Synod a renewed desire to deal better with this important problem. They deserve to be given warm encouragement in this endeavor. Young people without religious support. 42. My thoughts turn next to the ever-increasing number of children and young people born and brought up in a non-Christian, or at least non-practicing home, but who wish to know the Christian faith. They must be ensured a catechesis attuned to them, so that they will be able to grow in faith and live by LT more and more, in spite of the lack of support or even the opposition they meet in their surroundings. Adults. 43. To continue the series of receivers of catechesis, I cannot fail to emphasize now one of the most constant concerns of the Synod Fathers, a concern imposed with vigor and urgency by present experiences throughout the world. I am referring to the central problem of the catechesis of adults. This is the principal form of catechesis because it is addressed to persons who have the greatest responsibilities and the capacity to live the Christian message in its fully developed form. 90. The Christian community cannot carry out a permanent catechesis without the direct and skilled participation of adults, whether as receivers or as promoters of catechetical activity. The world in which the young are called to live and to give witness to the faith which catechesis seeks to deepen and strengthen is governed by adults. The faith of these adults too should continually be enlightened, stimulated and renewed, so that it may pervade the temporal realities in their charge. Thus, for catechesis to be effective, it must be permanent, and it would be quite useless if it stopped short at the threshold of maturity, since catechesis, admittedly under another form, proves no less necessary for adults. Quasi-catechumens. 44. Among the adults who need catechesis, our pastoral missionary concern is directed to those who were born and reared in areas not yet Christianized, and who have never been able to study deeply the Christian teaching, that the circumstances of life have at a certain moment caused them to come across. It is also directed to those who in childhood received a catechesis suited to their age, but who later drifted away from all religious practice, and as adults find themselves with religious knowledge of a rather childish kind. It is likewise directed to those who feel the effects of a catechesis received early in life, but badly imparted, or badly assimilated. It is directed to those who, although they were born in a Christian country, or in sociologically Christian surroundings, have never been educated in their faith, and, as adults, are really catechumens. Diversified and complementary forms of catechesis. 45. Catechesis is therefore for adults of every age, including the elderly persons, who deserve particular attention in view of their experience and their problems, no less than for children, adolescents, and the young. We should also mention migrants, those who are bypassed by modern developments, those who live in areas of large cities which are often without churches, buildings, and suitable organization, and other such groups. It is desirable that initiatives meant to give all these groups a Christian formation, with appropriate means, audiovisual aids, booklets, discussions, lectures, should increase in number, enabling many adults to fill the gap left by an insufficient or deficient catechesis, to complete harmoniously at a higher level their childhood catechesis, or even to prepare themselves enough in this field to be able to help others in a more serious way. It is important also that the catechesis of children and young people, permanent catechesis, and the catechesis of adults should not be separate watertight compartments. It is even more important that there should be no break between them. On the contrary, their perfect complementarity must be fostered. Adults have much to give to young people and children in the field of catechesis, but they can also receive much from them for the growth of their own Christian lives. It must be restated that nobody in the Church of Jesus Christ should feel excused from receiving catechesis. This is true even of young seminarians and young religious, and of all those called to the task of being pastors and catechists. They will fulfill this task all the better if they are humble pupils of the Church, the great giver as well as the great receiver of catechesis. 6. SOME ways and means of catechesis. Communications media. 46. From the oral teaching by the apostles, and the letters circulating among the churches down to the most modern means, catechesis has not ceased to look for the most suitable ways and means for its mission, with the active participation of the communities, and at the urging of the pastors. This effort must continue. I think immediately of the great possibilities offered by the means of social communication, and the means of group communication, television, radio, the press, records, tape recordings, the whole series of audiovisual means. The achievements in these spheres are such as to encourage the greatest hope. Experience shows, for example, the effect had by instruction given on radio or television, when it combines a high aesthetic level and rigorous fidelity to the magisterium. The Church now has many opportunities for considering these questions, as, for instance, on social communications days, and it is not necessary to speak of them at length here, in spite of their prime importance. Utilization of various places, occasions, and gatherings. 47. I am also thinking of various occasions of special value which are exactly suitable for catechesis, for example, diocesan, regional or national pilgrimages, which gain from being centered on some judiciously chosen theme based on the life of Christ, of the Blessed Virgin, or of the saints. Then there are the traditional missions, often too hastily dropped, but irreplaceable for the periodic and vigorous renewal of Christian life. They should be revived and brought up to date. Again, there are Bible study groups, which ought to go beyond exegesis and lead their members to live by the Word of God. Yet other instances are the meetings of ecclesial basic communities, insofar as they correspond to the criteria laid down in the apostolic exhortation Evangelii Nuntiandi. 91. I may also mention the youth groups, that, under varying names and forms, but always with the purpose of making Jesus Christ known, and of living by the gospel, are in some areas multiplying and flourishing in a sort of springtime that is very comforting for the Church. These include Catholic action groups, charitable groups, prayer groups, and Christian meditation groups. These groups are a source of great hope for the Church of tomorrow. But, in the name of Jesus, I exhort the young people, who belong to them, their leaders, and the priests, who devote the best part of their ministry to them, no matter what it costs, do not allow these groups, which are exceptional occasions for meeting others, and which are blessed with such riches of friendship and solidarity among the young, of joy and enthusiasm, of reflection on events and facts, do not allow them to lack serious study of Christian doctrine. If they do, they will be in danger, a danger that has unfortunately proved only too real, of disappointing their members, and also the Church. The catechetical endeavor that is possible in these various surroundings, and in many others besides, will have all the greater chance of being accepted and bearing fruit, if it respects their individual nature. By becoming part of them in the right way, it will achieve the diversity and complementarity of approach that will enable it to develop all the riches of its concept, with its three dimensions of word, memorial, and witness doctrine, celebration, and commitment in living, which the Synod message to the people of God emphasized. 92. The Homily. 48. This remark is even more valid for the catechesis given in the setting of the liturgy, especially at the Eucharistic assembly. Respecting the specific nature and proper cadence of the setting, the homily takes up again the journey of faith put forward by catechesis and brings it to its natural fulfillment. At the same time, it encourages the Lord's disciples to begin anew each day their spiritual journey in truth, adoration, and thanksgiving. Accordingly, one can say that catechetical teaching too finds its source and its fulfillment in the Eucharist, within the whole circle of the liturgical year. Preaching, centered upon the Bible texts, must then in its own way make it possible to familiarize the faithful with the whole of the mysteries of the faith and with the norms of Christian living. Much attention must be given to the homily. It should be neither too long nor too short. It should always be carefully prepared, rich in substance, and adapted to the hearers, and reserved to ordained ministers. The homily should have its place not only in every Sunday and feast day Eucharist, but also in the celebration of baptisms, penitential liturgies, marriages, and funerals. This is one of the benefits of the liturgical renewal. Catechetical Literature. 49. Among these various ways and means, all the Church's activities have a catechetical dimension. Catechetical works, far from losing their essential importance, acquire fresh significance. One of the major features of the renewal of catechetics today is the rewriting and multiplication of catechetical books taking place in many parts of the Church. Numerous very successful works have been produced, and are a real treasure in the service of catechetical instruction. But it must be humbly and honestly recognized that this rich flowering has brought with it articles and publications which are ambiguous and harmful to young people, and to the life of the Church. In certain places, the desire to find the best forms of expression, or to keep up with fashions and pedagogical methods has often enough resulted in certain catechetical works which bewilder the young and even adults, either by deliberately or unconsciously omitting elements essential to the Church's faith, or by attributing excessive importance to certain themes at the expense of others, or, chiefly, by a rather horizontalist overall view out of keeping with the teaching of the Church's magisterium. Therefore, it is not enough to multiply catechetical works. In order that these works may correspond with their aim, several conditions are essential. They must be linked with the real life of the generation to which they are addressed, showing close acquaintance with its anxieties and questionings, struggles and hopes. B. They must try to speak a language comprehensible to the generation in question. C. They must make a point of giving the whole message of Christ and His Church, without neglecting or distorting anything, and in expounding it they will follow a line and structure that highlights what is essential. D. They must really aim to give to those who use them a better knowledge of the mysteries of Christ, aimed at true conversion, and a life more in conformity with God's will. Catechisms. 50. All those who take on the heavy task of preparing these catechetical tools, especially catechism texts, can do so only with the approval of the pastors, who have the authority to give it, and taking their inspiration as closely as possible from the general catechetical directory, which remains the standard of reference. 93. In this regard, I must warmly encourage episcopal conferences of the whole world to undertake, patiently, but resolutely, the considerable work to be accomplished in agreement with the Apostolic See in order to prepare genuine catechisms which will be faithful to the essential content of Revelation, and up-to-date in method, and which will be capable of educating the Christian generations of the future to a sturdy faith. This brief mention of ways and means of modern catechetics does not exhaust the wealth of suggestions worked out by the Synod Fathers. It is comforting to think that at the present time every country is seeing valuable collaboration for a more organic and more secure renewal of these aspects of catechetics. There can be no doubt that the Church will find the experts and the right means for responding, with God's grace, to the complex requirements of communicating with the people of today. 7. HOWTO Impart Catechesis. Diversity of Methods. 51. The age and the intellectual development of Christians, their degree of ecclesial and spiritual maturity, and many other personal circumstances demand that catechesis should adopt widely differing methods for the attainment of its specific aim, education in the faith. On a more general level, this variety is also demanded by the social and cultural surrounding in which the Church carries out her catechetical work. The variety in the methods used is a sign of life and a resource. That is how it was considered by the fathers of the Fourth General Assembly of the Synod, although they also drew attention to the conditions necessary for that variety to be useful and not harmful to the unity of the teaching of the one faith at the service of revelation and conversion. 52. The first question of a general kind that presents itself here concerns the danger and the temptation to mix catechetical teaching unduly with overt or masked ideological views, especially political and social ones, or with personal political options. When such views get the better of the central message to be transmitted, to the point of obscuring it and putting it in second place, or even using it to further their own ends, catechesis then becomes radically distorted. The Synod rightly insisted on the need for catechesis to remain above one-sided divergent trends, to avoid dichotomies even in the field of theological interpretation of such questions. It is on the basis of revelation that catechesis will try to set its course, revelation, as transmitted by the universal magisterium of the Church, in its solemn or ordinary form. This revelation tells of a creating and redeeming God, whose Son has come among us in our flesh, and enters not only into each individual's personal history, but into human history itself, becoming its center. Accordingly, this revelation tells of the radical chance of man, and the universe, of all that makes up the web of human life, under the influence of the good news of Jesus Christ. If conceived in this way, catechesis goes beyond every form of formalistic moralism, although it will include true Christian moral teaching. Chiefly, it goes beyond any kind of temporal, social or political messianism. It seeks to arrive at man's innermost being, the message embodied in cultures. 53. Now a second question. As I said recently to the members of the Biblical Commission, the term acculturation, or inculturation, may be a neologism, but it expresses very well one factor of the great mystery of the Incarnation. 94. We can say of catechesis, as well as of evangelization in general, that it is called to bring the power of the gospel into the very heart of culture and cultures. For this purpose, catechesis will seek to know these cultures and their essential components. It will learn their most significant expressions. It will respect their particular values and riches. In this manner, it will be able to offer these cultures the knowledge of the hidden mystery. 95, and help them to bring forth from their own living tradition original expressions of Christian life, celebration, and thought. Two things must, however, be kept in mind. On the one hand, the gospel message cannot be purely and simply isolated from the culture in which it was first inserted, the biblical world, or, more concretely, the cultural milieu in which Jesus of Nazareth lived, nor, without serious loss, from the cultures in which it has already been expressed down the centuries. It does not spring spontaneously from any cultural soil. It has always been transmitted by means of an apostolic dialogue, which inevitably becomes part of a certain dialogue of cultures. On the other hand, the power of the gospel everywhere transforms and regenerates. When that power enters into a culture, it is no surprise that it rectifies many of its elements. There would be no catechesis if it were the gospel that had to change when it came into contact with the cultures. To forget this would simply amount to what Saint Paul very forcefully calls emptying the cross of Christ of its power. 96. It is a different matter to take, with wise discernment, certain elements, religious or otherwise, that form part of the cultural heritage of a human group, and use them to help its members to understand better the whole of the Christian mystery. Genuine catechists know that catechesis takes flesh in the various cultures and milieux. One has only to think of the peoples with their great differences, of modern youth, of the great variety of circumstances in which people find themselves today. But they refuse to accept an impoverishment of catechesis through a renunciation or obscuring of its message by adaptations, even in language, that would endanger the precious deposit of the faith. 97. Or by concessions in matters of faith or morals. They are convinced that true catechesis eventually enriches these cultures by helping them to go beyond the defective or even inhuman features in them, and by communicating to their legitimate values the fullness of Christ. 98. The contribution of popular devotion. 54. Another question of method concerns the utilization in catechetical instruction of valid elements in popular piety. I have in mind devotions practiced by the faithful in certain regions with moving fervor and purity of intention, even if the faith underlying them needs to be purified or rectified in many aspects. I have in mind certain easily understood prayers that many simple people are fond of repeating. I have in mind certain acts of piety practiced with a sincere desire to do penance or to please the Lord, underlying most of these prayers and practices. Besides elements that should be discarded, there are other elements which, if they were properly used, could serve very well to help people advance towards knowledge of the mystery of Christ and of His message, the love and mercy of God, the incarnation of Christ, His redeeming cross and resurrection, the activity of the Spirit in each Christian and in the Church, the mystery of the hereafter, the evangelical virtues to be practiced, the presence of the Christian in the world, etc., And why should we appeal to non-Christian or even anti-Christian elements refusing to build on elements which, even if they need to be revised or improved, have something Christian at their root? Memorization. 55. The final methodological question, the importance of which should at least be referred to one that was debated several times in the Synod, is that of memorization. In the beginnings of Christian catechesis, which coincided with a civilization that was mainly oral, recourse was had very freely to memorization. Catechesis has since then known a long tradition of learning the principal truths by memorizing. We are all aware that this method can present certain disadvantages, not the least of which is that it lends itself to insufficient, or at times almost non-existent, assimilation, reducing all knowledge to formulas that are repeated without being properly understood. These disadvantages and the different characteristics of our own civilization have in some places led to the almost complete suppression, according to some, alas, the definitive suppression, of memorization in catechesis. And yet certain very authoritative voices made themselves heard on the occasion of the Fourth General Assembly of the Synod, calling for the restoration of a judicious balance between reflection and spontaneity, between dialogue and silence, between written work and memory work. Moreover, certain cultures still set great value on memorization. At a time when, in non-religious teaching in certain countries, more and more complaints are being made about the unfortunate consequences of disregarding the human faculty of memory, should we not attempt to put this faculty back into use in an intelligent and even an original way in catechesis, all the more since the celebration, or memorial, of the great events of the history of salvation require a precise knowledge of them, a certain memorization of the words of Jesus, of important Bible passages, of the Ten Commandments, of the formulas of profession of the faith, of the liturgical texts, of the essential prayers, of key doctrinal ideas, etc., far from being opposed to the dignity of young Christians, or constituting an obstacle to personal dialogue with the Lord, is a real need, as the Synod Fathers forcefully recalled. We must be realists. The blossoms, if we may call them that, of faith and piety do not grow in the desert places of a memory, less catechesis. What is essential is that the texts that are memorized must at the same time be taken in and gradually understood in depth, in order to become a source of Christian life, on the personal level and the community level. The plurality of methods in contemporary catechesis can be a sign of vitality and ingenuity. In any case, the method chosen must ultimately be referred to a law that is fundamental for the whole of the Church's life, the law of fidelity to God, and of fidelity to man in a single loving attitude. 8. The joy of faith in a troubled world. Affirming Christian identity. 56. We live in a difficult world in which the anguish of seeing the best creations of men slip away from Him and turn against Him creates a climate of uncertainty. 99. In this world, catechesis should help Christians to be, for their own joy and the service of all, light and salt. 100. Undoubtedly, this demands that catechesis should strengthen them in their identity, and that it should continually separate itself from the surrounding atmosphere of hesitation, uncertainty, and insipidity. Among the many difficulties, each of them a challenge for faith, I shall indicate a few in order to assist catechesis in overcoming them. In an indifferent world. 57. A few years ago, there was much talk of the secularized world, the post-Christian era. Fashion changes, but a profound reality remains. Christians today must be formed to live in a world which largely ignores God, or which, in religious matters, in place of an exacting and fraternal dialogue, stimulating for all, too often flounders in a debasing indifferentism, if it does not remain in a scornful attitude of suspicion in the name of the progress it has made in the field of scientific explanations, to hold on, in this world, to offer to all a dialogue of salvation. 101. In which each person feels respected in his or her most basic dignity, the dignity of one who is seeking God. We need a catechesis which trains the young people and adults of our communities to remain clear and consistent in their faith, to affirm serenely their Christian and Catholic identity, to see Him who is invisible 102, and to adhere so firmly to the absoluteness of God that they can be witnesses to Him in a materialistic civilization that denies Him with the original pedagogy of the faith. 58. The irreducible originality of Christian identity has for corollary and condition no less original a pedagogy of the faith. Among the many prestigious sciences of man that are nowadays making immense advances, pedagogy is certainly one of the most important. The attainments of the other sciences, biology, psychology, sociology, are providing it with valuable elements. The science of education and the art of teaching are continually being subjected to review, with a view to making them better adapted or more effective, with varying degrees of success. There is also a pedagogy of faith, and the good that it can do for catechesis cannot be overstated. In fact, it is natural that techniques perfected and tested for education in general should be adapted for the service of education in the faith. However, account must always be taken of the absolute originality of faith. Pedagogy of faith is not a question of transmitting human knowledge, even of the highest kind. It is a question of communicating God's revelation in its entirety. Throughout sacred history, especially in the Gospel, God Himself used a pedagogy that must continue to be a model for the pedagogy of faith. A technique is of value in catechesis only to the extent that it serves the faith that is to be transmitted and learned, otherwise it is of no value. Language suited to the service of the Credo. 59. A problem very close to the preceding one is that of language. This is obviously a burning question today. It is paradoxical to see that, while modern studies, for instance in the field of communication, semantics, and symbology, attribute extraordinary importance to language, nevertheless language is being misused today for ideological mystification, for mass conformity in thought, and for reducing man to the level of an object. All this has extensive influence in the field of catechesis, for catechesis has a pressing obligation to speak a language suited to today's children and young people in general, and to many other categories of people: the language of students, intellectuals, and scientists, the language of the illiterate or of people of simple culture, the language of the handicapped, and so on. Saint Augustine encountered the same problem and contributed to its solution for his own time with his well-known work De Catechis and De Scriptibus. In catechesis as in theology, there is no doubt that the question of language is of the first order. But there is good reason for recalling here that catechesis cannot admit any language that would result in altering the substance of the content of the creed under any pretext whatever, even a pretended scientific one. Deceitful or beguiling language is no better. On the contrary, the supreme rule is that the great advances in the science of language must be capable of being placed at the service of catechesis so as to enable it really to tell or communicate to the child, the adolescent, the young people, and adults of today the whole content of doctrine without distortion. Research and certainty of faith. 60. A more subtle challenge occasionally comes from the very way of conceiving faith. Certain contemporary philosophical schools, which seem to be exercising a strong influence on some theological currents, and, through them, on pastoral practice, like to emphasize that the fundamental human attitude is that of seeking the infinite, a seeking that never attains its object. In theology, this view of things will state very categorically that faith is not certainty, but questioning, not clarity, but a leap in the dark. These currents of thought certainly have the advantage of reminding us that faith concerns things not yet in our possession, since they are hoped for, that as yet we see only, in a mirror dimly 103, and that God dwells always in inaccessible light. 104. They help us to make the Christian faith not the attitude of one who has already arrived, but a journey forward, as with Abraham. For all the more reason one must avoid presenting as certain things which are not. However, we must not fall into the opposite extreme, as too often happens. The letter to the Hebrews says that faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. 105. Although we are not in full possession, we do have an assurance and a conviction. When educating children, adolescents, and young people, let us not give them too negative an idea of faith, as if it were absolute non-knowing, a kind of blindness, a world of darkness, but let us show them that the humble yet courageous seeking of the believer, far from having its starting point in nothingness, in plain self-deception, in fallible opinions, or in uncertainty, is based on the Word of God, who cannot deceive or be deceived, and is unceasingly built on the immovable rock of this Word.